The time is 5:59 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to the September 24th edition of Labor Radio, of the working class, for the working class, by the working class. I'm Amanda Hill, here with my co-host Jamie Partridge.
Hey, Amanda.
Hey, Jamie. This evening, we have with us Adrian Inghouse, president of the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. Welcome, Adrian.
Hi, thank you.
We're also going to have with us a little later in the program, Lewis Brennan, an activist and bargaining team member with the Burgerville Workers Union.
Not here quite yet.
Not here quite yet, but we're expecting him soon. So, Adrian, your union, which happens to be my union also, has been in negotiations with one of your employers, Kaiser Permanente, for the past several months. Would you share with our listeners the tone of those talks?
Well, they're very different than they have been in the past. They have been much more traditional. I mean, to back up, Kaiser's part of a... we've been part of a labor management partnership with Kaiser for a long time. We've been involved in a coalition, which recently changed to an alliance with different unions. But at the end of the day, those conversations have always been done not in a traditional manner. And so this time they were very traditional and we got a lot of pushback. We were miles apart. And just the traditional trading proposals sitting across the table from each other.
Not very partnerly,
yeah, no.
So, Kaiser playing hardball. How did Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals change your approach to bargaining in that situation?
Well, it actually, I would say that OFNHP, is what we call ourselves for short, has changed our approach entirely, is we, about a year and a half ago, really were convicted and changed our message and the way we do business and really moved ourselves from a service union to an organizing model union where frontline workers were, you know, empowered and activated. We're really membership driven. And we believe in developing power from the shop floor. So shop stewards were activated. We had building unit representatives. Every building had a representative. And they were really integral in spreading the word. And our members have been really frustrated for a long time at Kaiser's lack of partnership. It's been very problematic. But right now, and the staffing and not feeling like they have a voice. And so when negotiations opened, it was really an opportunity for our members to rise up and say, you know, enough is enough and have a voice. And I think sometimes in a partnership, that isn't the forefront of what you do. I think sometimes in a partnership, there's a lot of peacemaking on both sides. Mm-hmm. And so, when you can put that aside and you let workers and health professionals really have a voice and what's important for their patients, they're going to speak up.
Let me back up a little bit and ask you this additional question. It's something that the labor movement as a whole is confronting more or less, depending on the union, this idea of moving from a servicing model to an organizing model. Can you say a little bit more about what that means?
Well, for us, we didn't have a strong servicing model, but we had enough of a servicing model that we needed to buck the tradition a little bit.
What does it mean? What does servicing model mean?
Well, to us, it meant that the business rep or the organizers, as we call them, did all the work. They filed the grievance. They interacted with management. They cut the deal. And we have moved away from that. So when we, if we find that we need to demand to bargain, there's a bargaining team elected out of the group, the work group, those people go to the table and bargain. Now, there's someone there to help guide them, but they make those decisions. They interact with management. They learn how to ask for data. The same with the stewards. You know, it's really empowering to a steward to know the contract and be able to say, go into management and defend a coworker, go through a joint discovery and say, no, nope, that's not going to work. That's not fair. You're not playing fair. That's not just cause. And it does not have to be a professional. Now, we have professionals that work for us. They're awesome. And they guide and teach and develop our frontline workers, and myself even included. You know, I was a steward 10 years ago. Still am. I mean, I still think of myself as a steward. And honestly, even today, they help me think things through from the professional point of view, the legal point of view, things I may not know. So we work as a team, but the frontline workers are very empowered. It is their decision at the end of the day, whether they take a deal, don't take a deal, you know, what it's going to look like for them.
And full disclosure, I was on the bargaining team for Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals during this season. And I want you to talk a little bit about how we change that up a little bit at the table. Traditionally, you bargain each contract separately, and we took a different approach. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I call it my Teamster approach. We put everyone at the table together for all the contracts. The bargaining team was really, it meant we were more powerful. So instead of like settling with one of the, a large group like the RNs, which the employer would then be very motivated to settle with the RNs and not with the techs or not with the pros, which are two of the other contracts, then the RNs are settled and the techs and pros aren't. So now your largest group that could go on strike, you've lost your leverage, right? Because you have these other two smaller groups that weren't settled. And it would be in the employer's favor to stagger things and settle with one group or not the other, and it'd be divisive. So we decided to all go to the table together and just bargain our common interests. Staffing is a common interest. There's no health professional that I would talk to today that would say, my staffing is fabulous and I don't need any help with that. So we bargain staffing language for all the contracts. Differentials, they're common. You know, almost every professional has an evening differential, a night differential, a standby, you know, some variation of that. So we bargained improvements on differentials.
You mean like a certain special higher pay for more?
Correct. Like if you work evening shift, you might get another $1.50 an hour or something. That isn't a suggestion, Kaiser. That was just a number I threw out there. We bargain that for everyone. And then longevity steps. Every single contract had a maximum number of longevity steps. So what a longevity step is, means how many years you've worked for the organization or how much experience you had. And so we added a longevity step of 2.5% because so many of our long-term employees had maxed out and were at the top of the scale. So this allowed them to have another jump in pay plus their COLA. So that was exciting. That was good. And so we have all those things in common, and it strengthened the bond between the bargaining units and the bargaining unit leadership. And I think generally our membership, they really felt like they had each other's back. And so I think that was really important. So it meant we had the full force of our 4,000 members instead of just the RNs, just the techs, just the pros.
Yeah, and having been at that table, I can say that Kaiser didn't like this approach. They wanted to separate us up at every juncture. They tried over and over throughout the bargaining. So Adrian, you know, there's been a lot of activity in the strike zone, shall we say, in Southwest Washington and across the nation, actually, with the teachers going out on strike and other organizations too. I just saw the other day that 48,000 nurses went out on strike in, I think it was Michigan.
Yeah, Michigan's out.
And so, you know, what do you think that type of activity, how do you think that played a part in our bargaining with Kaiser?
Well, first of all, I know they were preparing for a strike. They had hired a consulting firm. There were ads around the country from this firm, AMI, AMI is a staffing consulting firm, but they recently purchased a firm that hires SCABs. So we found out that by doing some research. We know that they were preparing to hire SCABs. We actually had travelers in the building who we call those SCABs are called travelers when we're not on strike. And so they were not in the building. They were in the building and they were saying, oh, we were hired to break your strike. Huh. And management said, what are you talking about? I said, well, why would some nurse from Louisiana come walking into Clackamas, Oregon and say, I'm here to break your strike when she doesn't even know when our contract that our contract expires. So they got called out. But then in return, our members were mad enough about two-tier pensions, losing some of their benefits, that they were determined. They would have gone out on strike. There was no doubt. We had a very, very credible strike threat. Mm-hmm. And I think that did change the tide. They still didn't back off very easily, but at the end of the day, neither did our members. Our members were very tenacious. And the thing is, once you see a nurse or a health professional out on the street, you know that there's something really wrong inside. They just don't leave their patients. They're just not a group that will leave. But I think the teachers inspired our members as well. I think they really did. There's a lot of inspiration with those teachers walking out.
And they're facing a lot of the same conditions, unable to serve the people that they're trying to serve because of understaffing, big class sizes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm sorry, they're just so underpaid. It is unconscionable the way teachers who build the foundation of our country by educating our children are treated and paid. I just am often mystified. But we walked their picket line. We were very proud of them for going out on strike.
I was very participatory. Thrilled to be on a picket line with teachers in Vancouver, and there was a mom with her kids there, and I said, "So, you know, how come you're out here today?" Well, I'm a mom, and my kids go to this school, but I'm also a member of the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. I'm in solidarity.
Yeah, our members are becoming quite the activists, and it's an awesome thing to see. I'm really proud. I'm really proud of where we've come in the last year and a half.
Great. Well, so can you tell us how other labor and community organizations played a role in these negotiations?
Well, J with J, of course, which is Jobs with Justice. They were a huge participant. They've always been very supportive, but they also showed up at our picket lines and helped us. Our picket lines, though, were primarily our members. So we had over 1,000 people out on the picket lines for informational pickets. The carpenters endorsed us. The laborers endorsed us. Northwest Labor Council came and helped us. And they all not only showed up, you know, Janelle Bynum from Happy Valley, a legislator, helped us. They not only showed up on the picket line, but they passed resolutions by their boards to endorse us and stand by us and send Kaiser a message that staffing was important to them as purchasers of the Kaiser products, but it was also important to them because their sisters and brothers in another union were saying it was important. So they really took our side and had our backs.
Yeah, I felt it definitely, especially out on the picket line, having people that were not in my own union out there supporting us and hearing the stories. I mean, healthcare is like teaching. It is affecting the entire community. So that was really awesome to see that happen. So, Adrian, as we close out on your section, do you have any advice for other unions that are going into bargaining?
Well, we started prepping a long time ago. So we were behind, and we started prepping a year and a half ago. I say the number one thing that we did was we found out what was important to our members, and we kept that as our center all the time. As long as we were driving for what was important to our members, we knew that they would respond and react. It was their issue. It's make it their issue, not the unions, you know, and that was what was important to them became very important to the staff and myself, and we made sure it was important to Kaiser at the end of the day, too.
All right. If you just turned in, this is KBOO Portland. You're listening to Labor Radio, and we've been talking to Adrian Enghaus, president of the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, about the settlement, the recent settlement on the Kaiser struggle for our union contract. Thank you so much, Adrian.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
And now we're going to turn to Lewis Brennan of the Burgerville Workers Union, the first federally recognized fast food workers union in the country. Currently, after 2 years of organizing. Oh, and hello, Lewis.
Hi.
Thank you for coming in, slipping in silently. After 2 years of organizing, strikes, and other direct actions, the Burgerville Workers Union has two National Labor Relations Board recognized shops, one at the 92nd and Southeast Powell, and the other in Gladstone. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
So let's a little background on Burgerville. It's a fast food restaurant with how many locations, and where are they, and how many workers?
There are 42 locations. It's all sort of centered around the Portland area. They're actually were founded and based in Vancouver, Washington, but they have a range along Northeast Oregon and Southwest Washington, from as far south as Corvallis, as far north as Centralia, and there's one out in the Dalles. So
basically a local chain.
Basically local.
Yeah. So tell us about the kind of work that you and others do at Burgerville.
Well, it's a burger joint for folks who haven't been there. We make burgers. We grill burgers, assemble them, send them out the door. We do drive-through and counter service. A wide range of times. Some places do breakfast, some doesn't. I actually work at the airport location, and we pick up those gates at 4:30 in the morning, start slinging out breakfast burgers.
Mm. Wow. Cooking burgers, it sounds pretty easy, but I understand that this is actually quite hazardous work.
I mean, it can be hazardous. You're working with deep fat fryers, you're working with hot grills, slippery floors, you know, kind of stuff. It's like a kitchen, you know. It's a normal kitchen, I'd say that given the number of new hires I have to work with at every single day, I'll say that there are things that you need to learn to do this job well.
And if someone gets injured, how is that handled at one of your locations?
Well, it depends on what the context is and what the severity is. I mean, I think that there's a lot of legal protections around OSHA and all that regards, although, you know, not every store has a functioning safety committee. There was always little things, and, you know, management drags their feet when things cost money to fix changes. I'll say at my store right now, there's no glaring issues, but we've had things in the past at other stores, you know, places where there are slip hazards, parts of the fryer that are chronically busted and they don't go and fix it. And, that's one of the main reasons we've been building the union, is to have, you know, workers need to have a voice on the job and need to be able to exert some real power to demand the conditions that they need and to be safe and healthy in the workplace.
What about wages and benefits?
Yeah, that's another major thing. I mean, Burgerville is a low-wage employer. They start at minimum wage, which has grown, thankful to the worker progressive laws that have been passed recently. But it's a pretty narrow band. Right now, I personally make $14 an hour, which is more than most Burgerville workers. As I said, it starts at minimum wage, and most people are not much more than that. So we're talking, I think minimum wage is $12 an hour, something like that. So,
what about scheduling? What's that? How's that situation shake out for Burgerville workers?
Well, again, with the progressive laws that have been getting passed, we have I don't know what the legal name is for it, but the Fair Scheduling Act, and so we get it a week ahead of time. We get their schedule. Before the union went public and before the law was passed, it was difficult. Oftentimes, you would find your schedule ahead 2 days ahead of time. You know, come out the Sunday when the schedule starts on Monday, and there's plenty of workers who don't have a set schedule. Their schedule changes all the time, especially if they're newer or if they're just not liked by management. And that's one of the main things we're trying to get changed at all the Burgervilles, but especially the ones where we're currently bargaining, trying to have a fair and consistent scheduling policy.
So, you know, the scheduling is obviously one of your demands, wages and benefits, and safety. Are there any other items that you have at the table?
Yeah, one of our major things that we're foregrounding is around the protection around workers' immigration status. I mean, we want Workable to be a sanctuary employer. We want them to not go above and beyond, to be cooperating with the deportation machine. And I mean, we think that this is a really dangerous time for marginalized workers in general, whether they're undocumented or whether they're trans or workers of color. And I think that you need to be fighting for the protections of those workers in the community and in the workplace at large. And I think we're foregrounding that as well.
Now, recently I saw that some workers had gotten in trouble for wearing buttons, and that's associated with exactly what you're talking about here, correct?
Right. So we've had I don't know what word we're using. I'll call it the button battle. We've got...
we know buttons.
We've had a kerfuffle, yeah. So workers forever have been wearing sort of personalized buttons, whether they, you know, supporting their own or their family's military service, or their love of their favorite Pokemon, or even political messages that people felt strongly about. Since the union has been public, workers have been wearing union buttons, whether it's, you know, we need a raise, or I support the Perkerville Workers Union, things like that. Recently, workers at 82nd and Gleason had been wearing buttons that support Black Lives Matter and the call to abolish ICE. And given the climate that we're in, apparently there were some customer complaints to management about that. And the company came in and they decided that they were going to disallow all buttons that weren't company issued or narrowly defined around National Labor Relations Act rights, so wages, working conditions, and union things.
Mm-hmm.
So specifically, they did this at the 82nd and Gleason location, where we don't have federal recognition, but we have an active union committee, and we're acting as a union. We are a union there. And the general manager came in and said, told employees that they couldn't wear their buttons anymore, and gave them the option. They could either go home, or they could take their buttons off. And 10 workers on that day took the option to go home.
Wow.
And refused to take their buttons off. So it was a sort of impromptu strike of some sorts.
Solid.
After some publicity and after the reality that management faced of having to actually work, they pulled back that policy and allowed workers to come back, wear whatever buttons they wanted, like they had been before, and gave workers back pay for that day when they were sent home. It was a victory. A few weeks later, we were at the bargaining table with the company around the two stores where we have recognition, and they did two things. First, they discussed the button policy with us and talked about what it would look like at stores where we were bargaining the contract, and they said that they would work with the union going forward about their button policy. Well, again, flash forward a couple weeks, and all of a sudden, every Burgerville has a paper policy that's getting distributed to paper policy that's getting distributed that articulates a uniform policy around buttons that is exactly the same as the one they attempted to implement at 82nd and Gleason. It disallows all buttons that aren't company-issued or narrowly defined NLRA-protected buttons. So basically, they went back on exactly what they said they would do at the bargaining table. They are trying to implement it in the locations where we are bargaining a contract currently, and we think this is unacceptable. So we filed unfair labor practice charges with the National Labor Relations Board around the violations of the National Labor Relations Act that we think this is. But we've also taken action because we know that workers' power is in direct action and solidarity and not first and foremost in the law. So just on Tuesday, which happened to be National Cheeseburger Day.
Perfect timing.
workers at the 82nd and Gleason location and the 92nd and Powell location went on strike over these unfair labor practices. The National Cheeseburger Day is a common day for major promotions for Burgerville. So they were doing Dollar Cheeseburger Day. You could get cheeseburgers for a dollar. So they're always very busy. At the 82nd Gleason store, we had 12 workers walk out. At the 92nd Appel store, we had 10 workers walk out. And we held pickets down during the lunch and the dinner rushes at 82nd Gleason. And, showed them how we feel about their violations of labor law and their violations of our rights to be who we are and express our investments, whether those are political investments or personal investments in superheroes being who we are at work.
Mm-hmm. So you've received support from folks in the labor movement and wider community, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the most important, one of the most important parts of our campaign so far is the amount of support we've gotten from the community. I mean, Burgerville thinks of themselves as a community institution. They think of themselves as a community company. The community is workers, and so we want to show them where the community really stands, which is with us. So we have support from Jobs with Justice. We've got support from OFNHP. Mm-hmm. We've got support from the carpenters have been a real big help to us. The longshoremen have been a big help. The teachers, I don't want to leave people out necessarily.
There's
a whole long list. There's a whole long list.
I've been part of an action where there was outside of I think it was the Convention Center, Burgerville, where the carpenters had set up a grill and were giving away free burgers. To dissuade people from going to buy burgers.
Yeah, the grill rig is a real big fan of ours. I think that's, the carpenters have been really generous.
I think I was at that one as well. So what are your next steps to achieve the demands that you have at the bargaining table?
Well, we go back to bargaining on October 10th, so hopefully we'll see some change in mood from the company then. And, we're going to continue to escalate, continue to use the power we have, stand with the community. The biggest thing right now for folks out there listening is that we still are calling for a boycott. So however good those burgers I described earlier are, we're very sorry. We're asking you to hold off still till Burgerville gives us what we demand. And I think that that's a really important thing. Part of escalation is to show Burgerville that the community is workers and workers stand with other workers. And they're not going to be able to operate their business like they want to until they do right by their employees.
Yeah, I have many friends that have been asking me, when is it over? When is it over? I said, it's not over till I tell you it's over. So
there you go. Thank you.
Adrian herself is just craving a Marionberry shake over there.
Oh, they're done. You missed your chance. Hopefully next year.
I sent them a letter and explained to them my frustration at missing Marionberry season, and I wish that they'd settle a fair contract now so I could get in on pumpkin spice season. But, I guess I'm going to have to send them another letter. So.
Well, I strongly encourage you to follow Adrian's lead. They on their website, they have contact us forms and their mailing address. You're welcome to communicate with the company about your displeasure with their labor practices.
I think I'm going to send the last 5 shake series that they've had and say I've had to miss this one as strawberry and Marionberry and pumpkin. And are you really going to make me miss this next season by not settling a fair contract? I'm sure I could have supported just in shake sales.
Exactly. You can also hit Burgerville up on Facebook or Instagram and respond in their comments. I responded in their comments and they responded back to me. And really? We had a little dialogue. It was kind of fun.
So we have a couple more minutes. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this, the Burgerville Workers campaign, or that our, if our listeners want to learn more, get involved in supporting you, how they can connect?
So we have our Facebook page, we have a website, and you're more than welcome to visit those and find out more. Where we post regular updates. I want to represent also that we're a part of the Industrial Workers of the World, which is a larger union from all around the world, and especially in North America, and that we support all workers organizing. We're not industry specific, and we're always looking for folks to help support folks standing up. So if you want to make changes in your workplace, if you want to help, if you know someone who wants to make changes in your workplace, feel free to contact us. Our website is portlandiww.org, we'll be happy to stand with y'all.
Well, thanks for joining us tonight, Lewis. Go to their Facebook page, support them, stop eating those burgers and shakes until they get a fair contract. Thanks.
Thank you.
You can hear this and other shows archived at the www.kboo.fm. So if you know somebody who ought to hear this and missed us tonight, tell them to check it out later.
And thanks also to our engineer, Mike. And stay tuned for Prison Pipeline. Come back next week for more Labor Radio. Good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Warning, the following message is only for listeners who contributed during KBOO's Fall Membership Drive. If you did not contribute to KBOO's Fall Membership Drive, please turn off your radio now.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's Fall Membership Drive. Your support makes KBOO possible. Thank you.
If you didn't contribute during KBOO's Fall Membership Drive, you may now turn your radio back on.
It's not too late. Go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution right now.
Then the next time this spot plays, you'll be able to listen.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Killer of Sheep on Wednesday, October 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Filmed in Watts in 1975, Killer of Sheep follows a working man in a moment of existential crisis, trying to make ends meet at a job he finds repugnant, and trying to connect with his family and community. The Library of Congress declared Killer of Sheep a national treasure and one of the first 50 films on the National Film Registry. Again, that's Killer of Sheep on Wednesday, October 3rd.